Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman, and Cindy Wolf is on vacation in France. And today we are doing a program on vintages, vintage variations, what in the world is a vintage? And we have a series of guests who will help explain that a lot more clearly than I will. My first is a distinguished gentleman, an American who's been living and working in Bordeaux at Signature Selections, a wine merchant there, for quite a long time. And Jeffrey Davies. Jeffrey, how are you today?
I'm good, Tony. It's great to hear from you.
So how long have you been monitoring what's going on in Bordeaux?
I set up my business here as what we call a négociant 30 years ago.
So how in the world do you stay in business when every vintage is so different and every vintage has to be bought, has to be sold? And, you know, for consumers that are only used to wines that have very limited variation in vintage, say from Northern California or further south, or maybe the very south of Italy, again, where there's very little vintage variation. What are the things that, what makes up a vintage in Bordeaux?
Well, first of all, how do I stay in business is a very delicate balancing act, because you do have some of the incredibly great vintages. Those that come to mind of late would be 09, 2010, and to just a very slightly lesser extent, 2015. But I think the further north we go, and especially when we get up to the 45th parallel, even with global warming, there are more pronounced vintage variations here, as you pointed out a moment ago, than you might find in my native California or in some of the climes in the Southern Hemisphere. That being said, I think that progress both in vineyard management and in winemaking have planed or have reduced some of the peaks and valleys that we might otherwise have found if we were still doing like we did only 25 or 30 years ago.
I recall contacting you about 2013 because that's a vintage that's a year of the birth of my daughter, and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to sock away a lot of great wine from 2013. What was the result of 2013, and what would have been the result had it been 20 years ago, vineyard management and winemaking?
Good question. I think it was one of the most difficult vintages that I have witnessed here since the early 90s, maybe 91 or 2, and probably clear back to 77, 74. I mean, we had everything thrown at us, and yet, by careful vineyard management, by careful selective harvesting, by careful selecting of the individual berries that actually went into the fermentation tanks, by monitoring and following each of those tanks individually, and then ultimately by selecting only the best lots once they'd fermented and aged, I think we produced wines that were far more palatable than any of us might originally have guessed they would turn out to be. The problem is twofold. One, there is very little of them because many properties probably only bottled, at least as their so-called grand vin, their first wine, maybe 30 to 35% of their total crop. That was something we didn't do back in the 70s, 80s, or even the 90s. And the other problem is an eternal one in Bordeaux, is how do you price these vintages? So sometimes we have vintages that, in fact, can be quite good, but perhaps they're not priced right, and therefore, over time, people assimilate them as being a lesser vintage simply because they weren't priced properly. That was true in 2007, for example. Lots of delicious wines, but they were priced a bit high.
The pricing question is not just tricky wines relative to wines, but wines relative to the world market, because Bordeaux's that one product that, you know, is... I mean, the effect of, say, the Chinese introduction as a big client and as a big consumer. I mean, what a difference did that make with the pricing of nines and tens? And what a difference has that made with the lesser vintages that followed, 11, 12, 13, you know, as far as the ability for the Bordelais to sell those wines with pace?
That's a complex question that I would try to answer as follows. It is clear that In 9 and 10, the Chinese thought that buying wines on futures, that is, paying for them before they were even bottled, was going to be a real get-rich-quick scheme. And goodness knows the Chinese are often attracted to such schemes. It probably worked to a certain extent with the 2009 vintage, but the prices in 2010 even escalated beyond the stratospheric heights they'd already achieved in 2009. And then the Chinese started to find out that they couldn't turn a big profit and an immediate profit on those 2010s. In many cases, what happened is they simply refused to take delivery and to pay for those 2010s, leaving tens of millions of euros worth of wine here in Bordeaux. That was sort of the end of the Chinese gold rush. However, the Chinese market has not disappeared in spite of their crackdown on corruption and bribery and gift-giving and so forth. But what has happened is they come in and buy a lot of the vintages that, for example, the American market does not want. And the best example is the one you mentioned, 2013, because the wines are, I would say, almost Burgundy-like, very, very fruity, thoughtful, soft, aromatic, 30-drinking wines that are considerably less expensive than were the 9s and 10s, let alone more recent vintages. So they can get a Grand Cru Classé with the name of Lafitte Rothschild or Margaux or Aubryon on it for a fraction of the price that they would have paid for 2009 and 10. And that, to them, is great. They're not as concerned as we are in the U.S. about the innate or intrinsic vintage quality as they are about drinking a famous label.
So, Jeffrey, one thing that's on my mind differently is the effect that Brexit will have, the British leaving the EU, on the Bordeaux wine market, and what is the effect going to be? How do you plan for that?
Yeah, being the astute student of history that you are, you know that Bordeaux and England's fate have been tied together for centuries, and Britain has been a major pole for the buying and selling of Bordeaux wines. I think much of the Bordeaux wine that has been sold to England over the last few decades has not even stayed in England, but rather has found its way either to the United States or to Hong Kong and China. It's become a real hub for wine trading. I think all of this will settle, and when the dust does settle, I think you will see the UK and England back in the game. There will be a temporary shock here with the pound having fallen by 10 or 12%. However, we still did business in the UK on this 2015 futures campaign, but I think the merchants were very savvy in that as soon as they made a purchase, they bought the currency so they'd be protected. I think another thing that may happen is, as you know, there are quite a lot of stocks of Bordeaux and other wines in the UK, which are suddenly going to be devalued by somebody, for someone who's buying them with a currency other than the pound sterling, which could make them very attractive. In other words, as the pound sterling falls, exports from the UK become much more attractive. And since they are sitting on a lot of stocks that are paid for and are in England and will be billed in pound sterling, I think that we'll see a lot of those wines being offered around the world, and they will probably find buyers.
So let me go to something a little more honestly close to your heart and interesting, if that's okay, for at least some listeners. So what is the big deal? What makes a vintage worthwhile? What has to happen in the spring? What has to happen in the summer? Is someone was going to tell the tale of, or would you tell the tale of, things happened exactly right to make great Bordeaux wines in a given year? What has to happen? And then can you think of any of those years?
Yeah. The weather's been so crazy in its patterns. In fact, I don't even know if we can call them patterns anymore. It's become so disparate from one year to another that it's very hard to answer that question. But I suppose that ideally, come the month of May, you hope that you're going to get through the month of May without any freezes, without any hail damage, so that the so-called flowering can take place in ideal conditions. And those ideal conditions would be cool to warm, without any heavy rains, without any hail, obviously, and without any freezes, all of which they have had, as you've probably heard, in parts of Burgundy, Beaujolais, and especially in Chablis. And a lot of people over there on the eastern side of France are looking at crops that are down as much as 30 to 70%, if not more, and not just for 2016, but there will be extended damage into 2017.
Yeah, I'm just back from Burgundy, and there are many tears.
Yeah, it's really tragic. And then in June and July, you want to have warm weather, dry weather, but with occasional light rains so that the vines do not go into what we call hydric or water stress. That is very important here because unlike in California and lots of other places throughout the world, under Appellation Contrôlée laws, we do not have the right to irrigate. So we do need some moisture from time to time, and light, moderate rains in June, July, and beginning of August can actually be helpful. Come mid-August, the equinox, we hope that the weather will stay warm, but that we'll start to see cooler nights as we enter into the final ripening phase. And then September is the month where, again, we hope for warm days, cool nights, probably as little rain at that point as possible, unless we start to get some water stress. And then usually we'll begin harvesting in an ideal vintage in the third to fourth week of September, and depending on where we are in Bordeaux, depending on the soil type, depending on the grape variety, that can run out to the middle of October or occasionally a little bit beyond. But there's an old saying in French that juin fait le vin, août fait le moût, which tends to suggest that by the flowering in June or May and June, you determine the potential quantity of wine you're going to have, but then it's the weather that you get, particularly in August, that will determine the quality of wine we're going to have. And as you know, between the flowering and the actual harvesting of the ripe fruit, we generally consider that there's going to be 110, 115 days go by.
So it's funny, I was thinking, as you were saying that, about 2008, 2009, you were talking about how different years are.
Mm-hmm.
And when was harvest in 2008 versus 2009? This is a year apart.
Yeah. Well, what happened in 2008, as I recall, is we had a fairly cool summer, and then we got some pretty substantial rains at the end of August and in early September, which caused many journalists, notably from Paris, to begin writing off the vintage before they'd even come down here and before the grapes had even been harvested. It was only a mutual friend of ours, Bob Parker, who came over here the following March and tasted the 2008 and thought, wow, this is quite a remarkable vintage, particularly in light of the weather that they had at the beginning of September. But the rest of September and most of October, as you will recall, was warm days, cool nights, and absent most of the rains that had plagued us right at the cusp of August and September. And so while they're not quite as generous and flashy as the 2009s that came along a year later, there's some great values to be had, especially, and great drinking pleasure to be had, especially on the right bank in Saint-Emilion and Pomerol, where the wines are mainly made from Merlot. Mm-hmm. 2009 was just something you see maybe once or twice in a lifetime, with just incredible warm weather conditions throughout the growing season and wines with extraordinarily ripe skins and therefore very ripe, soft tannins and relatively high sugars, so that we had a lot of wines here in Bordeaux where we don't necessarily expect that were over 14% alcohol and occasionally over 15%. In 2010, we had a similar situation, but even warmer and drier, and there we probably gained another 0.5% or more in percentage of alcohol. So we have some of the richest, ripest wines that we've ever made in Bordeaux.
And most of the 10s have a little bit better pH to offset the alcohols, too.
That's what we hope, because as those wines age down the road, we're hoping that the alcohol will be kept in balance by that very acidity and by the flesh of the wine, yeah. But the 2009s continue for the time being to be much flashier and much more accessible.
In recent vintages, do you have a particular pet vintage Pet wine that you think consumers should be paying attention to that have not paid attention to?
I think the vintage that really surprised us, because when we tasted it from barrel, so-called en primeur, it wasn't terribly impressive, and we thought the wines were a bit dilute. And yet, 18 or so months later, when we tasted those same wines from bottle, we were all nonplussed by how fleshy, fruity sweet even, that many of them had become. And that vintage is, of course, 2012. And the prices, because early on we had perhaps underestimated their innate quality, the prices were low, relatively speaking. And those are great, great values today for those of you who can still find them in your local markets. After that, I think 14 is going to have a lot of very good surprises for us, especially now that we're just ending the 2015 futures campaign, where the prices are up substantially by comparison to 2014. It's going to make a lot of those 2014s look exceptionally attractive. 2015, on the other hand, great wines, but not always great prices. And it's the eternal battle that is fought between the producers and the négociants here in Bordeaux, as you know. I still think a number of wines that I've tasted in the 2015 vintage are among the best that their chateau have produced in recent memory, if not in my lifetime. I think in particular some of the wines like Château Canon in Saint-Emilion, Toro Mondo is way up there, Cheval Blanc is spectacular. There's so many I could go on and on. And so many properties that people haven't yet heard about that have done a great job and whose wine will be going out of Bordeaux at less than $20 a bottle. And quite frankly, being a native Californian from the San Francisco Bay Area, while everybody talks about the very expensive wines from Bordeaux, some of which are among the best in the world, few people take the time to look at and to talk about the great value wines that are being produced here in Bordeaux, and that's really a shame, because there are lots and lots of them in this vintage.
One of the things I always think of with Bordeaux, Jeffrey, is exactly what you're saying, which is that if you have the effect of a truly excellent vintage like 9, 10, 15, you can drink well-made wines from modest places and still have something very tasty, something very touchable, and something reasonable at a young age to consume. If you're trying to consume one of the monsters from one of the great years, if you don't have the patience to leave it alone for a while in the cellar, it's a bit of a shame. You may have wasted your money, and it's the opposite of that excellent purchase.
Yeah, I would just add one nuance to that. I think that...
Nuance? You disagree with me.
No, but since the 82 vintage in particular, I think we've come to understand one thing, and that is that if the tannins, which as you know are contained in the skins of the grape, if we get those really ripe, even to the extent where we don't pay attention to the sugar content or the acidity of the grapes, we will make wines that are extraordinarily ripe and that will have a much larger window during which we can really enjoy them. And that window will open very early, and it will last quite a long time. I mean, the 82s, for example, I would say that they were good out of the barrel, good out of the bottle, as soon as they were released, and the best ones are still great today. And I think that's been one of the significant changes in Bordeaux over the last 35, 40 years, is we're harvesting and looking for different things to determine when we harvest, which when we find them, and that's, again, namely these very ripe tannins in the skins of the grapes, that we're making wines that are much more enjoyable early on without, I don't believe, compromising their ability to age. Will they age for a century? I don't know. And it really doesn't matter to me because I won't be here to find out. But what I do know is the 5s, the 9s, the 10s, many of them already delightful to drink, even if we sense that they haven't hit their peak plateau and that they will continue to age well and gracefully for a very long time where they're well stored. So I think a little bit, or to a certain extent, we kind of have the best of both worlds.
Well, Jeffrey, thanks for coming on the program.
Look forward to seeing you next time I'm in Baltimore.
See you soon.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye. Now, that was fascinating from Jeffrey, as always. In our next segment on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine, we have Martine Chaumette from Domaine de Bissou in Beaujolais on WYPR. Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman, and Chef Cindy Wolf is on vacation. And our program today is all about vintages, vintage variation, and what it means in different places in the world. My next guest is Martin Chemet from Domaine de Vissou in the Beaujolais. Martin, how are you today?
Yes, I am fine. We are in the vineyard, and the sun has been shining the next last days. Finally.
In a vintage like 2016, it's very important to finally get a little sunshine, no?
Yes, we need sunshine because it has been very rainy in the last weeks.
The reports from Burgundy and Beaujolais is that this is going to be a very difficult vintage. What has made it difficult so far?
We don't know yet if the vintage will be difficult, but we have had the flower, you know, in the vineyard in the last week, and the sun has been shining, so it's a good thing for the flower, and which can announce a quite good quantity.
Oh, good.
But it's true that there has been a lot of hailstorms, some hailstorms in the north of Beaujolais and Mâcon. So.
But you are in the south of the Beaujolais, so you're a little bit protected, yes?
Yes, at the moment we are protected.
So would you take a few moments and tell a little bit of the history of the estate and family at Domaine de Vissou?
Yes, so the Domaine de Vissou is a family, has been a family estate since 17th century. So in the house of my father's parents, we can find a stone with a date. So originally it was a farm with cultivating cereals, and a little vineyard, and also there were we have had cows until a few years ago, and in this century the vineyard has been expanding, especially since the 17th, and now the Domaine de Vissou has only one activity, is producing and selling wines.
How many hectares do you have of vines?
We have 40 hectares.
And what different wines do you produce?
So we produce a whole range of Beaujolais wines, starting from the entry-level Beaujolais wines, called simply Beaujolais. We produce in majority in red, with Gamay. And we also have 5 hectares of Chardonnay to produce the white Beaujolais. And we also have a production of rosé from the Gamay grape. That is for the Beaujolais. With the Chardonnay, we also produce a sparkling wine called Crémant de Bourgogne, which we have in Brut, dry, extra dry, and rosé, too, for the Crémant. We also have some plots in the north of the region, in the region of the Cru. So this region produces higher-level wines, which can age a little bit, up to 10 years, for example. And there we produce 2 Fleuries, and 2 moulins à vent, and also 1 Brouilly. So Fleury, moulin à vent, and Brouilly are 3 of the 10 crus existing in Beaujolais.
Which is your favorite of the 3, typically?
My favorite is is the Fleury Poncier. Fleury Poncier is, we could say, a kind of feminine wine. So it's a wine with floral aromas, which is elegant and which is fine with soft tannins. And this fleury can match with a lot of dishes, with many food, even with some fish, which is not usual for red.
I always think that's, having tasted wines from Domaine de Vissou for many years, or at least the last 20 years or so, the fleury pensier is usually my favorite of the production also. And I usually find I like it best between age 4 and age 6.
Yes, it's also my opinion, so we have the same opinion.
Is there a particular vintage that is your favorite that you recall of that fleury pensier?
2009 was really great. Also 14 is also a very typical Beaujolais vintage, and the 15 is quite different. With it's a very rich and powerful vintage.
Having tasted recently at your estate, the 15s reminded me a little bit of 9, but almost more of one of the old vintages in Beaujolais, 1976.
76, yes.
Mm-hmm. With all of that muscle.
Mm-hmm. 76 has been also one of the vintage in my memory, which I keep in my memory.
Could you take a moment and tell listeners about recent vintages that they might find if they go and see wines from Vissou and or wines from Beaujolais in general in stores? Maybe tell us about the character of 14, 13, 12, 11.
The different characters?
Yes, please.
Of the vintage?
A little advice on what to expect.
11 is a quite rich vintage, but with some finesse, however. And now it's really the right time to drink it, because the aromas are now being transformed. And I very much like these wines, these cru in Beaujolais, when they reach, as you said, about from three to 6 years old. So 11 is, I think, is now mature to drink. And then 14 is a little young, but it's a drinkable vintage because it's a very typical Beaujolais cru. It's in the Beaujolais style. That means it can be drank on the foot, young, with a little of vivacity, and on the freshness. So it's a youth. It's the youth. It's of a wine. And the 15 will arrive soon in the U.S., but they are still young, but they have a lot of aromas, and they are complex and strong. And I think 15 is a vintage for American drinkers, American amateur.
We will like the richness, in other words.
Yes, I think so.
I think everyone likes the richness, not just us.
Yes. What we try to do in Domaine du Vissou is to produce natural wines, and also to vinificate in a natural way so that the terroir can express itself. We try to do terroir wines. Not only a great variety wine, but a terroir wine. For example, when we do the Tout Fleury, Pensier, and Les Garants, which are two different plots, they are quite different. This can show the variety of the wines in Beaujolais.
It's the same grape and it's the same cru, but it's two different sites, so two different expressions.
Yes, and the two plots are not far away. They are quite close. It's the originality of Beaujolais, and I like it. The landscape has a great variety, and I think the wines are like the landscape. So
I agree with you. I always think of Beaujolais, especially excellent Beaujolais from the cruise, as being a bit underappreciated by our market and having more food flexibility than many, many wines of France, not just the rest of the world too, but of France. It's the wines are often thought of as wines of Burgundy, and I find them often in character more like wines of the Northern Rhone than the wines of Burgundy, than the Pinot Noir, because of the granite and the soil being such an overriding characteristic in the Northern Rhone.
Yes, and my husband often say that the Gamay can age a very long time. Gamay can age some people, some journalists, like Revue du Vin de France, they did some articles on very old Beaujolais cru from the 60s, 70s, but they can really last age until 10, 15 years.
Yeah, no question, especially in excellent vintages and excellent houses. Well, Martine,
yes.
Thank you very much for coming on the program and sharing about Domaine de Vissou and Beaujolais and giving us an idea of what different vintages mean to growing Beaujolais wines. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your call and for your visit in Domaine du Vissou.
Of course.
Thank you very much.
À la prochaine. Merci beaucoup.
À la prochaine. Au revoir.
Au revoir.
Bye-bye.
So we will have links up for the interviews today on the Formula Wolf page on WIPR.org for Brezza, for signature selections from Jeffrey Davies, and for Domaine du Vissou. So you can get familiar with what their offerings and see photographs of some of the sites and what they're doing. When we return on Formula Wolf on Food and Wine on WIPR, we have an interview with Enzo Brezza from Brezza in Barolo, and we'll get his take on vintages and also a response to listener email on WIPR. Welcome back to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman, and Chef Cindy Wolf is on vacation. And for our final interview, I have Enzo Brezza, a favorite winemaker from Barolo in the northwest of Italy, in Piemonte. And his family has a long history, and he can give his good perspective on vintages in Piemonte and in Italy and what they mean for them and what makes up a vintage. Enzo, how are you?
Good, good. And you?
Very well, thank you.
Good.
So maybe give us a brief history of Brezza and tell us what you produce.
Brezza is a fourth-generation family winery. We have only vineyards the property. We not buy any grape, any wine. And we make only single grape wine, like tradition in Piemonte. The typical grape from Piemonte, Dolcetto, Freisa, Barbera, and Nebbiolo. Is 95% is red wine because we are in the Lange, located in the Lange, the typical area for red wine. And yes, we have a very different vintage. Very good, really, in the last 10, 15 years. We are very lucky.
So take us, and some of the wines you produce are from the Barolo zone and from some of the crus, correct?
Yes. Yes, when we make all the label, we make five different Barolo. We make one Barolo we call Classico. It's more the idea of the Barolo until the 70s, when all the vineyards, all the cellar present just one Barolo, each cellar, and more a blend, a character of blend of different soil, different microclimate. And we make three single vineyards in Barolo, is Castellero, Canubi, and Sarmazza. And we make a Barolo Reserva, not every year. It's a selection in the Sarmazza vineyard. It's called Sarmazza Vigna Brico. We sell after 6 years.
Very good. And some of the other varietals are more for drinking anytime, the Barbera, the Dolcetto.
Yes.
The Fresa.
Yes, we have also a fantastic local grape, like Dolcetto is our more local wine for every day. 100% Dolcetto is a very good grape to combine with food, normally with pasta or with meat and salami, and is the early grape picking. For example, the Nebbiolo is the late grape picking. It's more like middle of October, end of October. For the Dolcetto, it's more like around middle of September, 1 month early than Nebbiolo, and it's a very good grape for every day, for make a very good wine. We have only single grape wine. Single grape mean it's really a wine really attached to the vintage. Every year it's something different, some different emotions, some different wine, because it's so natural to be different every year, because the climate is different. We have a very continental climate, very different season, a very distinct season, and we not do irrigation. It's illegal to do in our area the irrigation, and we have quite a nice amount of water in between, like 800 to 1,200 millimeters of water in 1 year. Quite a well distribution also more in the spring, like April, May. After in the autumn, after the harvest, and normally in November, it's quite a nice rain, and we have snow in the winter. And every vintage is something different. For me, for example, for the single grape wine, it's very important the grape grower. You need to do the best in the vineyards, and after to respect the quality of the wine. To not try to do something different. It's more, you don't need to make mistake in the cellar, but you need to respect the quality of the wine. If the for example, if the vintage is very difficult, we not make Barolo.
Yeah.
We make only in the good best vintage.
Is there a recent vintage that you were able to make only a small amount or couldn't really make Barolo?
But we, for example, we really not make Barolo in 2002. It was a little bit difficult vintage. We have also some, in 2002, we have also some oil problem. Was quite late oil, and it destroyed also part of the production.
How was 2013? In 2013, and so much of France was difficult for red wines. How was 2013 for Barolo?
2013?
Yeah.
2013 was, the start was quite difficult because we have in the spring quite low temperature, especially April, May, and quite a lot of rain. Was a little bit problem in the start, especially for mildew. Was quite a strong attack of mildew, but we are certified organic. We use only copper and sulfate in the vineyards. And we stopped the mildew, and after we have a really late picking season. Was quite a vintage, like classic vintage, more like end of October picking, and the quality was really nice. Was quite a little bit more tannic wine, quite a wine for long aging, nice acidity. Nice potential for aging, but was a good vintage. Yes, for example, in France, in Burgundy was Burgundy have many problems in the last 4 or 5 years, especially for the also for the quantity, for really low quantity. We recently have a problem with frozen in this this spring. Have quite a big problem with the frozen low production, and no, we are really lucky. In the last 10-15 years, we have really maybe one two vintages not really in the top. For example, a difficult vintage like 2014 was quite a cold summer, quite a wet vintage. But for the late grape, like Nebbiolo, was especially in the Barbaresco area more than Barolo area, rain, like, for example, in Barbaresco area in 2014, was 200 millimeter of water less than Barolo area. For Nebbiolo grape, was quite a nice vintage, really. It was difficult for the early red wine, for example, for Dolcetto and especially Barbera. For example, 2015 was the best grape, was the Barbera grape. In 2014, was the worst grape. Okay. Every grape and every vintage is different, and sometimes it's very good vintage for all the grape. Sometimes it's better for the late grape, like Nebbiolo. Sometimes better for the early grape. So it depends on the vintage.
So the vintages and the harvest time for the different grapes are big factors back and forth, a little bit differently from some other places in the world. Would you maybe tell me favorite vintages for you of wines from Barolo from the last, say, 30 years? What have your favorites been?
It's many, many, many good vintages. Like,
but I'm forcing you to choose three.
Choose for a vintage. I like very much 99. I like 2004. 2006 for me is amazing vintage. I like really, really, really good because it's have a nice acidity, nice fresh character, but also very good body and very promise vintage. Also for aging the wine, very nice potential aging. For example, also extremely hot vintage like 2003, now drinking very well. It's fantastic wine for drink now. It show really the beauty of the evolution, but still very fresh and nice. Normally for the warmer vintage, the Barolo is more approachable young, have less acidity, more ready to drink when it's young. For the classic vintage like 2006, the potential aging is 30, 40 years, so depend. For me already the Barolo I like very much also after 6 years. For me, it's quite a nice and vertical evolution in the first 3 years in the bottles. And after, it can be quite constant with small changing every year for 30 years or 40 years, so depend the vintage, the producer, and the cellar where you age the wine.
Of course. I guess I have one extra silly question for you. If there's a miracle and Italy beats Germany in the Euro Cup,
ooh,
what will you drink?
During the match, I like... It's not very good for a wine producer, but I like to drink beer when I watch game, soccer game.
During the match, beer is important.
Yeah, during the match for me, especially the match with Germany, I drink a German beer. Italy is very difficult team for Germany because always Germany
always
lost many games with Italy. It's very difficult partner to do the match with. I hope also this year, also in Saturday, Italy repeat what it does for many years. And after, I like really 2003. For me, it's fantastic. It's more a conversation wine, more a very friendly wine. Even for drink without food, maybe a little bit cheese, a little bit bread, but just it's a typical Barolo for drink with nice people, nice music, good friends, and really to concentrate in the wine to not like to not match anymore with the food, but to drink really for pleasure.
I have to say that for the guy who has German blood and no Italian blood, I hope you drink new 2003 soon.
Yeah, thank you very much. I hope to. Yes.
Well, thanks for coming on the program, Enzo.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Of course. Ciao.
Okay. Ciao. Bye-bye.
I find it interesting that listening to the three different voices, there's such different approaches. In Bordeaux, it's... And Jeff is a négociant and one that cares a great deal about wine, but it's a question of business and the business reality of Bordeaux for vintage variation. In the Beaujolais, which is not as famous a wine-growing region and doesn't have the giant economic upside, it's a just long family estate, and you can hear how personal it is when you hear Martin's voice. And for Enzo, it's a matter of pride and history, and there's, it is personal, but it is maybe more of a collected history in that particular part of Italy. I think the perspectives on what vintages mean in those places being a little different is pretty unique and human. Lastly, I have a listener email that I failed to answer on time for the dinner party, but I thought it was a great email, and I thought that it would be helpful for people to hear the answer. And I want to remind you, please send us emails to Foreman Wolf on the WIPR page. The address is foremanwolf@wipr.org. And this message, the email message, was from Elizabeth in Chestertown. Perfect timing for today's topic. I'm making a totally Eastern Shore dinner for six people tonight. Mark Bittman's tomato melon gazpacho, crab cakes with local asparagus, and a lemon verblanc sauce, and our first local sweet corn, followed by a salad of local peaches and blueberries. What wine or wines would Tony suggest with his menu? None of our guests are serious wine aficionados, so I want to keep it uncomplicated. I mean, it sounds like sort of first celebration of all the harvest from over there. I think the fruit of the end, honestly, I'd love to have sparkling wine that was maybe not the most serious stuff in the world, but really tasty. Maybe a nice Conca from Reventos, a nicer Spanish sparkling wine, or a good Cremant, maybe from the Jura, something like that. If it's with the meal, the asparagus is kind of the you have two strong things to deal with, the tomatoes and the asparagus. The melon will be a little bit sweet, but not terribly. You want something that's ripe. The asparagus is the strong flavor. Tomato means some acidity, but the asparagus is the dominant flavor you're dealing with. I think you're still looking at Suave Classico for that. And there are a number of very good producers. Pra is one that makes a richer style. And so I would look for that for a meal like this. Elizabeth, thanks for the email. If you want to send us an email, please send it to foremanwolf@wipr.org. If you want to download this program, if you missed any or any other programs, please go to the WIPR webpage and look for the Foreman and Wolf page that's on there, and all of the episodes are on there. And have a wonderful Sunday. Thanks so much for listening.